informed Perry. Easiest thing to hawk or sell. Cameras and TV sets. This being the case, they decided to obtain several of the latter, and having completed the mission, went on to attack a few more clothing emporiums. Shepherd and Foster's, Rothschild's, Shopper's Paradise. By sundown, when the stores were closing, their pockets were filled with cash and the car was heaped with saleable, pawnable wares. Surveying this harvest of shirts and cigarette lighters, expensive machinery and cheap cufflinks, Perry felt elatedly tall. Now, Mexico. A new chance. A really living life. But Dick seemed depressed. He shrugged off Perry's praises. "I mean it, Dick. You were amazing. Half the time I believed you myself." And Perry was puzzled. He could not fathom why Dick, usually so full of himself, should suddenly, when he had good cause to gloat, be meek, look wilted and sad. Perry said, "I'll stand you a drink." They stopped at a bar. Dick drank 3 orange blossoms. After the 3rd, he abruptly asked, "What about Dad?" "I feel... oh, Jesus. He's such a good old guy. And my mother... well, you saw her. What about them? Me, I'll be off in Mexico. Or wherever. But they'll be right here when those checks start to bounce. I know Dad. He'll want to make them good. Like he tried to before. And he can't. He's old and he's sick. He ain't got anything." "I sympathize with that," said Perry truthfully. Without being kind, he was sentimental, and Dick's affection for his parents, his professed concern for them, did indeed touch him. "But hell, Dick, it's very simple," Perry said. "We can pay off the checks. Once we're in Mexico, once we get started down there, we'll make money. Lots of it."
"How?"
"How?" What could Dick mean? The question dazed Perry. After all, such a rich assortment of ventures had been discussed. Prospecting for gold, skin diving for sunken treasure. These were but 2 of the projects Perry had ardently proposed. And there were others. The boat, for instance. They had often talked of a deep-sea fishing boat, which they would buy, man themselves, and rent to vacationers. This, though neither had ever skippered a canoe or hooked a guppy. Then, too, there was quick money to be made chauffeuring stolen cars across South American borders. You get paid $500 a trip, or so Perry had read somewhere. But of the many replies he might have made, he chose to remind Dick of the fortune awaiting them on Cocos Island, a land speck off the coast of Costa Rica. "No fooling, Dick," Perry said. "This is authentic. I've got a map. I've got the whole history. It was buried there back in 1821. Peruvian bullion, jewelry. $60 million. That's what they say it's worth. Even if we didn't find all of it. Even if we found only some of it. Are you with me, Dick?" Heretofore, Dick had always encouraged him, listened attentively to his talk of maps, tales of treasure, but now, and it had not occurred to him before, he wondered if all along Dick had only been pretending, just kidding him. The thought, acutely painful, passed, for Dick, with a wink and a playful jab, said, "Sure, honey, I'm with you, all the way." It was 3 in the morning, and the telephone rang again. Not that the hour mattered. Al Dewey was wide awake anyway, and so were Marie and their sons, 9-year-old Paul and 12-year-old Alvin Adams Dewey Jr. For who could sleep in a house, a modest 1-story house, where all night the telephone had been sounding every few minutes? As he got out of bed, Dewey promised his wife, "This time I'll leave it off the hook." But it was not a promise he dared keep. True, many of the calls came from news-hunting journalists, or would-be humorists, or theorists. "Al, Listen, fella, I've got this deal figured. It's suicide and murder. I happen to know Herb was in a bad way financially. He was spread pretty thin. So what does he do? He takes out this big insurance policy, shoots Bonnie and the kids, and kills himself with a bomb. A hand grenade stuffed with buckshot. Or anonymous persons with poison pen minds. Know them L's? Foreigners? Don't work? Give parties? Serve cocktails? Where's the money come from? Wouldn't surprise me a darn if they ain't at the roots of this clutter trouble. Or nervous ladies alarmed by the gossip going around, rumors that knew neither ceiling nor cellar. Alvin, now, I've known you since you were a boy, and I want you to tell me straight out whether it's so. I loved and respected Mr. Clutter, and I refuse to believe that that man, that Christian, I refuse to believe he was chasing after women. But most of those who telephoned were responsible citizens wanting to be helpful. I wonder if you've interviewed Nancy's friend, Sue Kidwell. I was talking to the child, and she said something that struck me. She said the last time she ever spoke to Nancy, Nancy told her Mr. Clutter was in a real bad mood. Had been the past 3 weeks. That she thought he was very worried about something, so worried he'd taken to smoking cigarettes. Either that or the callers were people officially concerned. Law officers and sheriffs from other parts of the state. This may be something, may not, but a bartender here says he overheard two fellas discussing the case in terms made it sound like they had a lot to do with it. And while none of these conversations had as yet done more than make extra work for the investigators, it was always possible that the next one might be, as Dewey put it, the break that brings down the curtain. On answering the present call, Dewey immediately heard, "I want to confess." He said, "To whom am I speaking, please?" The caller, a man, repeated his original assertion and added, "I did it. I killed them all." "Yes," said Dewey. "Now if I could have your name and address." "Oh, no, you don't," said the man, his voice thick with inebriated indignation. "I'm not going to tell you anything. Not till I get the reward. You send the reward, then I'll tell you who I am. That's final." Dewey went back to bed. "No, honey," he said. "Nothing important. Just another drunk."
What did he want?
"Wanted to confess. Provided we sent the reward first." A Kansas paper, the Hutchinson News, had offered $1,000 for information leading to the solution of the crime.
"Alvin, are you lighting another cigarette? Honestly, Alvin, can't you at least try to sleep?"
He was too tense to sleep, even if the telephone could be silenced. Too fretful and frustrated. None of his leads had led anywhere, except perhaps down a blind alley toward the blankest of walls. Bobby Rupp? The polygraph machine had eliminated Bobby. And Mr. Smith, the farmer who tied rope knots identical with those used by the murderer. He, too, was a discarded suspect, having established that on the night of the crime he'd been off in Oklahoma. Which left the Johns, father and son, but they had also submitted provable alibis. So, to quote Harold Nye, "It all adds up to a nice round number. Zero." Even the hunt for the grave of Nancy's cat had come to nothing. Nevertheless, there had been one or two meaningful developments. First, while sorting Nancy's clothes, Mrs. Elaine Seltzer, her aunt, had found tucked in the toe of a shoe a gold wristwatch. Second, accompanied by a KBI agent, Mrs. Helm had explored every room at River Valley Farm, toured the house in the expectation that she might notice something awry or absent, and she had. It happened in Kenyon's room. Mrs. Helm looked and looked, paced round and round the room with pursed lips, touching this and that. Kenyon's old baseball mitt, Kenyon's mud-spattered work boots, his pathetic abandoned spectacles. All the while she kept whispering, "Something here is wrong. I feel it. I know it, but I don't know what it is." And then she did know.
It's the radio. Where is Kenyon's little radio?
Taken together, these discoveries forced Dewey to consider again the possibility of plain robbery as a motive. Surely that watch had not tumbled into Nancy's shoe by accident. She must, lying there in the dark, have heard sounds. Footfalls, perhaps voices, that led her to suppose thieves were in the house, and so believing must have hurriedly hidden the watch. A gift from her father that she treasured. As for the radio, a gray portable made by Zenith. No doubt about it, the radio was gone. All the same, Dewey could not accept the theory that the family had been slaughtered for paltry profit. A few dollars and a radio. To accept it would obliterate his image of the killer. Or rather, killers. He and his associates had definitely decided to pluralize the term. The expert execution of the crimes was proof enough that at least one of the pair commanded an immoderate amount of cool-headed slyness and was, must be, a person too clever to have done such a deed without calculated motive. Then, too, Dewey had become aware of several particulars that reinforced his conviction that at least one of the murderers was emotionally involved with the victims and felt for them even as he destroyed them. A certain twisted tenderness. How else explain the mattress box? The business of the mattress box was one of the things that most tantalized Dewey. Why had the murderers taken the trouble to move the box from the far end of the basement room and lay it on the floor in front of the furnace, unless the intention had been to make Mr. Clutter more comfortable? To provide him, while he contemplated the approaching knife, with a couch less rigid than cold cement. And in studying the death scene photographs, Dewey had distinguished other details that seemed to support his notion of a murderer now and again moved by considerate impulses. Or, he could never quite find the word he wanted, something fussy and soft. Those bed covers. Now, what kind of person would do that? Tie up two women, the way Bonnie and the girl were tied, and then draw up the bed covers. Tuck them in, like sweet dreams and good night. Or the pillow under Kenyon's head. At first I thought maybe the pillow was put there to make his head a simpler target. Now I think, no. It was done for the same reason the mattress box was spread on the floor. To make the victim more comfortable. But speculations such as these, though they absorbed Dewey, did not gratify him or give him a sense of getting somewhere. A case was seldom solved by fancy theories. He put his faith in facts, sweated for and sworn to. The quantity of facts to be sought and sifted, and the agenda planned to obtain them, promised perspiration aplenty, entailing as it did the tracking down, the checking out of hundreds of people, among them all former River Valley Farm employees, friends and family, anyone with whom Mr. Clutter had done business, much or little, a tortoise crawl into the past. For as Dewey had told his team, we have to keep going till we know the Clutters better than they ever knew themselves. Until we see the connection between what we found last Sunday morning and something that happened maybe 5 years ago. The link. Got to be one. Got to. Dewey's wife dozed, but she awakened when she felt him leave their bed, heard him once more answering the telephone, and heard, from the nearby room where her son slept, sobs, a small boy crying.
Paul?
Ordinarily, Paul was neither troubled nor troublesome. Not a whiner, ever. He was too busy digging tunnels in the backyard or practicing to be the fastest runner in Finney County. But at breakfast that morning, he'd burst into tears. His mother had not needed to ask him why. She knew that although he understood only hazily the reasons for the uproar around him, he felt endangered by it. By the harassing telephone, and the strangers at the door, and his father's worry-wearied eyes. She went to comfort Paul. His brother, 3 years older, helped.
Paul, he said, you take it easy now, and tomorrow I'll teach you to play poker. Dewey was in the kitchen. Marie, searching for him, found him there, waiting for a pot of coffee to percolate and with the murder scene photographs spread before him on the kitchen table. Bleak stains, spoiling the table's pretty fruit-patterned oilcloth. Once he had offered to let her look at the pictures. She had declined. She had said, I want to remember Bonnie the way Bonnie was. And all of them. He said, maybe the boys ought to stay with Mother. His mother, a widow, lived not far off, in a house she thought too spacious and silent. The grandchildren were always welcome. For just a few days. Until. Alvin, do you think we'll ever get back to normal living? Mrs. Dewey asked. Their normal life was like this. Both worked, Mrs. Dewey as an office secretary, and they divided between them the household chores, taking turns at the stove and the sink. When Alvin was sheriff, I know some of the boys teased him. Used to say, look a yonder, here comes Sheriff Dewey, tough guy. Totes a six-shooter. But once he gets home, off comes the gun and on goes the apron. At that time, they were saving to build a house on a farm that Dewey had bought in 1951, 240 acres several miles north of Garden City. If the weather was fine, and especially when the days were hot and the wheat was high and ripe, he liked to drive out there and practice his draw, shoot crows, tin cans, or in his imagination roam through the house he hoped to have, and through the garden he meant to plant, and under trees yet to be seeded. He was very certain that someday his own oasis of oaks and elms would stand upon those shadeless plains. Someday, God willing. A belief in God and the rituals surrounding that belief. Church every Sunday, grace before meals, prayers before bed, were an important part of the Deweys' existence. I don't see how anyone can sit down to table without wanting to bless it, Mrs. Dewey once said. Sometimes when I come home from work, well, I'm tired. But there's always coffee on the stove and sometimes a steak in the icebox. The boys make a fire to cook the steak and we talk and tell each other our day, and by the time supper's ready, I know we have good cause to be happy and grateful. So I say thank you, Lord. Not just because I should, because I want to. Now, Mrs. Dewey said, Alvin, answer me. Do you think we'll ever have a normal life again? He started to reply, but the telephone stopped him. The old Chevrolet left Kansas City November 21st, Saturday night. Luggage was lashed to the fenders and roped to the roof. The trunk was so stuffed it could not be shut. Inside, on the back seat, two television sets stood, one atop the other. It was a tight fit for the passengers. Dick, who was driving, and Perry, who sat clutching the old Gibson guitar, his most beloved possession. As for Perry's other belongings, a cardboard suitcase, a gray Zenith portable radio, a gallon jug of root beer syrup, he feared that his favorite beverage might not be available in Mexico, and two big boxes containing books, manuscripts, cherished memorabilia, and hadn't Dick raised hell, cursed, kicked the boxes, called them 500 pounds of pig slop. These, too, were part of the car's untidy interior. Around midnight, they crossed the border into Oklahoma. Perry, glad to be out of Kansas, at last relaxed. Now it was true. They were on their way. On their way and never coming back. Without regret, as far as he was concerned, for he was leaving nothing behind, and no one who might deeply wonder into what thin air he'd spiraled. The same could not be said of Dick. There were those Dick claimed to love. Three sons, a mother, a father, a brother. Persons he hadn't dared confide his plans to or bid goodbye, though he never expected to see them again. Not in this life. Clutter English Vows Given in Saturday Ceremony. That headline, appearing on the social page of the Garden City Telegram for November 23rd, surprised many of its readers. It seemed that Beverly, the second of Mr. Clutter's surviving daughters, had married Mr. Vere Edward English, the young biology student to whom she had long been engaged. Miss Clutter had worn white, and the wedding, a full-scale affair, Mrs. Leonard Cohen was soloist and Mrs. Howard Blanchard organist, had been solemnized at the First Methodist Church, the church in which, 3 days earlier, the bride had formally mourned her parents, her brother, and her younger sister. However, according to the telegram's account, Vere and Beverly had planned to be married at Christmas time. The invitations were printed and her father had reserved the church for that date. Due to the unexpected tragedy and because of the many relatives being here from distant places, the young couple decided to have their wedding Saturday. The wedding over, the Clutter kinfolk dispersed. On Monday, the day the last of them left Garden City, the telegram featured on its front page a letter written by Mr. Howard Fox of Oregon, Illinois, a brother of Bonnie Clutter. The letter, after expressing gratitude to the townspeople for having opened their homes and hearts to the bereaved family, turned into a plea. "There is much resentment in this community," that is Garden City, wrote Mr. Fox. "I have even heard on more than one occasion that the man, when found, should be hanged from the nearest tree. Let us not feel this way. The deed is done, and taking another life cannot change it. Instead, let us forgive as God would have us do. It is not right that we should hold a grudge in our hearts. The doer of this act is going to find it very difficult indeed to live with himself. His only peace of mind will be when he goes to God for forgiveness. Let us not stand in the way, but instead give prayers that he may find his peace." The car was parked on a promontory where Perry and Dick had stopped to picnic. It was noon. Dick scanned the view through a pair of binoculars. Mountains. Hawks wheeling in a white sky. A dusty road winding into and out of a white and dusty village. Today was his second day in Mexico, and so far he liked it fine. Even the food. At this very moment, he was eating a cold, oily tortilla. They had crossed the border at Laredo, Texas, the morning of November 23rd, and spent the first night in a San Luis Potosí brothel. They were now 200 miles north of their next destination, Mexico City. "Know what I think?" said Perry. "I think there must be something wrong with us. To do what we did."
"Did what?"
"Out there." Dick dropped the binoculars into a leather case, a luxurious receptacle initialed HWC. He was annoyed. Annoyed as hell. Why the hell couldn't Perry shut up? Christ Jesus, what damn good did it do, always dragging the goddamn thing up? It really was annoying. Especially since they'd agreed, sort of, not to talk about the goddamn thing. Just forget it. "There's got to be something wrong with somebody who'd do a thing like that," Perry said.
"Deal me out, baby," Dick said. "I'm a normal."
And Dick meant what he said. He thought himself as balanced, as sane as anyone. Maybe a bit smarter than the average fellow, that's all. But Perry. There was, in Dick's opinion, something wrong with little Perry. To say the least. Last spring, when they had celled together at Kansas State Penitentiary, he'd learned most of Perry's lesser peculiarities. Perry could be such a kid, always wetting his bed and crying in his sleep. "Dad, I've been looking everywhere. Where you been, Dad?" And often Dick had seen him sit for hours just sucking his thumb and poring over them phony damn treasure guides. Which was one side. There were others. In some ways, old Perry was spooky as hell. Take, for instance, that temper of his. He could slide into a fury quicker than 10 drunk Indians. And yet, you wouldn't know it.
He might be ready to kill you, but you'd never know it.
Not to look at or listen to, Dick once said. For however extreme the inward rage, outwardly Perry remained a cool young tough, with eyes serene and slightly sleepy. The time had been when Dick had thought he could control, could regulate the temperature of these sudden cold fevers that burned and chilled his friend. He had been mistaken, and in the aftermath of that discovery, had grown very unsure of Perry, not at all certain what to think, except that he felt he ought to be afraid of him, and wondered really why he wasn't.
Deep down, Perry continued, way, way rock bottom. I never thought I could do it. A thing like that.
How about the nigger? Dick said.
Silence.
Dick realized that Perry was staring at him. A week ago in Kansas City, Perry had bought a pair of dark glasses. Fancy ones with silver lacquered rims and mirrored lenses. Dick disliked them. He'd told Perry he was ashamed to be seen with anyone who'd wear that kind of flit stuff. Actually, what irked him was the mirrored lenses. It was unpleasant having Perry's eyes hidden behind the privacy of those tinted reflecting surfaces.
But a nigger, said Perry. That's different.
The comment, the reluctance with which it was pronounced, made Dick ask,
or did you?
Kill him like you said. It was a significant question, for his original interest in Perry, his assessment of Perry's character and potentialities, was founded on the story Perry had once told him of how he had beaten a colored man to death.
Sure I did. Only a nigger. It's not the same.
Then Perry said,
know what it is that really bugs me? About the other thing? It's just that I don't believe it. That anyone can get away with a thing like that. Because I don't see how it's possible to do what we did and just 100% get away with it. I mean, that's what bugs me. I can't get it out of my head that something's got to happen.
Though as a child he had attended church, Dick had never come near a belief in God. Nor was he troubled by superstitions. Unlike Perry, he was not convinced that a broken mirror meant 7 years' misfortune, or that a young moon, if glimpsed through glass, portended evil. But Perry, with his sharp and scratchy intuitions, had hit upon Dick's one abiding doubt. Dick, too, suffered moments when that question circled inside his head. Was it possible? Were the two of them, honest to God, going to get away with doing a thing like that? Suddenly, he said to Perry, now just shut up. Then he gunned the motor and backed the car off the promontory. Ahead of him, on the dusty road, he saw a dog trotting along in the warm sunshine. Mountains. Hawks wheeling in a white sky. When Perry asked Dick, know what I think? He knew he was beginning a conversation that would displease Dick, and one that, for that matter, he himself would just as soon avoid. He agreed with Dick. Why go on talking about it? But he could not always stop himself. Spells of helplessness occurred, moments when he remembered things. Blue light exploding in a black room, the glass eyes of a big toy bear, and when voices, a particular few words, started nagging his mind.
Oh, no. Oh, please. No, 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 don't. Oh, please don't, please.
And certain sounds returned. A silver dollar rolling across a floor, boot steps on hardwood stairs, and the sounds of breathing, the gasps, the hysterical inhalations of a man with a severed windpipe. When Perry said, I think there must be something wrong with us, he was making an admission he hated to make. After all, it was painful to imagine that one might be not just right, particularly if whatever was wrong was not your own fault, but maybe a thing you were born with. Look at his family. Look at what had happened there. His mother
an alcoholic, had strangled to death on her own vomit. Of her children, two sons and two daughters, only the younger girl, Barbara, had entered ordinary life, married, begun raising a family. Fern, the other daughter, jumped out of a window of a San Francisco hotel. Perry had ever since tried to believe she slipped, for he'd loved Fern. She was such a sweet person, so artistic, a terrific dancer, and she could sing, too. If she'd ever had any luck at all, with her looks and all, she could have got somewhere, been somebody. It was sad to think of her climbing over a windowsill and falling 15 floors. And there was Jimmy, the older boy. Jimmy, who had one day driven his wife to suicide and killed himself the next. Then he heard Dick say, "Deal me out, baby. I'm a normal." Wasn't that a horse's laugh? But never mind. Let it pass. Deep down, Perry continued, way, way rock bottom, I never thought I could do it. A thing like that. And at once he recognized his error. Dick would, of course, answer by asking, "How about the nigger?" When he'd told Dick that story, it was because he'd wanted Dick's friendship, wanted Dick to respect him, think him hard, as much the masculine type as he had considered Dick to be. And so one day, after they had both read and were discussing a Reader's Digest article entitled, "How Good a Character Detective Are You?" As you wait in a dentist's office or a railway station, try studying the giveaway signs in people around you. Watch the way they walk, for example. A stiff-legged gait can reveal a rigid, unbending personality. A shambling walk, a lack of determination. Perry had said, "I've always been an outstanding character detective. Otherwise, I'd be dead today. Like if I couldn't judge when to trust somebody." You never can much. But I've come to trust you, Dick. You'll see I do, because I'm going to put myself in your power. I'm going to tell you something I never told anybody. Not even Willie J. About the time I fixed the guy. And Perry saw as he went on that Dick was interested. He was really listening. It was a couple of summers ago. Out in Vegas. I was living in this old boarding house. It used to be a fancy cat house. But all the fancy was gone. It was a place they should have torn down 10 years back. Anyway, it was sort of coming down by itself. The cheapest rooms were in the attic, and I lived up there. So did this nigger. His name was King. He was a transient. We were the only two up there. Us and a million cucarachas. King, he wasn't too young, but he'd done road work and other outdoor stuff. He had a good build. He wore glasses, and he read a lot. He never shut his door. Every time I passed by, he was always lying there, buck naked. He was out of work, and said he'd saved a few dollars from his last job. Said he wanted to stay in bed a while, read and fan himself, and drink beer. The stuff he read, it was just junk. Comic books and cowboy junk. He was okay. Sometimes we'd have a beer together, and once he lent me $10. I had no cause to hurt him. But one night we were sitting in the attic. It was so hot you couldn't sleep, so I said, "Come on, King, let's go for a drive." I had an old car I'd stripped and souped and painted silver. The Silver Ghost, I called it. We went for a long drive. Drove way out in the desert. Out there, it was cool. We parked and drank a few more beers. King got out of the car, and I followed after him. He didn't see I'd picked up this chain. A bicycle chain I kept under the seat. Actually, I had no real idea to do it till I did it. I hit him across the face. Broke his glasses. I kept right on. Afterward, I didn't feel a thing.
I left him there and never heard a word about it. Maybe nobody ever found him. Just buzzards. There was some truth in the story. Perry had known, under the circumstances stated, a Negro named King. But if the man was dead today, it was none of Perry's doing. He'd never raised a hand against him. For all he knew, King might still be lying abed somewhere, fanning himself and sipping beer. Or did you? Kill him like you said, Dick asked. Perry was not a gifted liar, or a prolific one. However, once he had told a fiction, he usually stuck by it. Sure I did. Only, a nigger, it's not the same. Presently, he said, know what it is that really bugs me? About that other thing? It's just that I don't believe it. That anyone can get away with a thing like that. And he suspected that Dick didn't either. For Dick was at least partly inhabited by Perry's mystical moral apprehensions. Thus, now just shut up! The car was moving. 100 feet ahead, a dog trotted along the side of the road. Dick swerved toward it. It was an old half-dead mongrel, brittle-boned and mangy, and the impact as it met the car was little more than what a bird might make. But Dick was satisfied. Boy, he said, and it was what he always said after running down a dog, which was something he did whenever the opportunity arose. Boy, we sure splattered him. Thanksgiving passed, and the pheasant season came to a halt, but not the beautiful Indian summer, with its flow of clear, pure days. The last of the out-of-town newsmen, convinced that the case was never going to be solved, left Garden City. But the case was by no means closed for the people of Finney County, and least of all for those who patronized Holcomb's favorite meeting place, Hartman's Cafe. Since the trouble started, we've been doing all the business we can handle, Mrs. Hartman said, gazing around her snug domain, every scrap of which was being sat or stood or leaned upon by tobacco-scented, coffee-drinking farmers, farm helpers, and ranch hands. Just a bunch of old women, added Mrs. Hartman's cousin, Postmistress Claire, who happened to be on the premises. If it was spring and work to be done, they wouldn't be here. But wheat's in, winter's on the way, they got nothing to do but sit around and scare each other. You know Bill Brown, down to the Telegram? See the editorial he wrote? That one, he called it, Another Crime? Said, it's time for everyone to stop wagging loose tongues. Because that's a crime, too, telling plain-out lies. But what can you expect? Look around you. Rattlesnakes, varmints, rumor mongers. See anything else? Ha! Like dash you do. One rumor originating in Hartman's Cafe involved Taylor Jones, a rancher whose property adjoins River Valley Farm. In the opinion of a good part of the cafe's clientele, Mr. Jones and his family, not the Clutters, were the murderer's intended victims. It makes harder sense, argued one of those who held this view. Taylor Jones, he's a richer man than Herb Clutter ever was. Now, pretend the fella who done it wasn't anyone from hereabouts. Pretend he'd been maybe hired to kill, and all he had was instructions on how to get to the house. Well, it would be mighty easy to make a mistake, take a wrong turn, and end up at Herb's place instead of Taylor's. The Jones theory was much repeated, especially to the Joneses, a dignified and sensible family who refused to be flustered. A lunch counter, a few tables, an alcove harboring a hot grill and an icebox and a radio. That's all there is to Hartman's Cafe. But our customers like it, says the proprietress. Got to. Nowhere else for them to go. Lest they drive 7 miles one direction or 15 the other. Anyway, we run a friendly place, and the coffee's good since Mabel came to work. Mabel being Mrs. Helm. After the tragedy, I said, Mabel, Now that you're out of a job, why don't you come give me a hand at the cafe? Cook a little. Wait counter. How it turned out, the only bad feature is everybody comes in here. They pester her with questions about the tragedy. But Mabel's not like Cousin Mert or me. She's shy. Besides, she doesn't know anything special. No more than anybody else.
But by and large, the Hartman congregation continued to suspect that Mabel Helm knew a thing or two that she was holding back. And of course, she did. Dewey had had several conversations with her and had requested that everything they said be kept secret. Particularly, she was not to mention the missing radio or the watch found in Nancy's shoe, which is why she said to Mrs. Archibald William Warren Brown, "Anybody reads the papers knows as much as I do. More. Because I don't read them." Square, squat, in the earlier 40s, an Englishwoman fitted out with an accent almost incoherently upper class, Mrs. Archibald William Warren Brown did not at all resemble the cafe's other frequenters and seemed, within that setting, like a peacock trapped in a turkey pen. Once, explaining to an acquaintance why she and her husband had abandoned family estates in the north of England, exchanging the hereditary home, the jolliest, oh, the prettiest old priory, for an old and highly unjolly farmhouse on the plains of western Kansas, Mrs. Warren Brown said, "Taxes, my dear. Death duties. Enormous, criminal death duties. That's what drove us out of England. Yes, we left a year ago. Without regrets. None. We love it here. Just adore it. Though, of course, it's very different from our other life. The life we've always known. Paris and Rome. Monte. London. I do occasionally think of London. Though I don't really miss it. The frenzy. And never a cab, and always worrying how one looks. Positively not. We love it here. I suppose some people, those aware of our past, the life we've led, wonder, aren't we the tiniest bit lonely out there in the wheat fields? Out west is where we meant to settle. Wyoming or Nevada. La vraie chose. We hoped when we got there some oil might stick to us. But on our way we stopped to visit friends in Garden City. Friends of friends, actually. But they couldn't have been kinder. Insisted we linger on. And we thought, well, why not? Why not hire a bit of land and start ranching? Or farming? Which is a decision we still haven't come to, whether to ranch or farm. Dr. Austin asked if we didn't find it perhaps too quiet. Actually, no. Actually, I've never known such bedlam. It's noisier than a bomb raid. Train whistles, coyotes, monsters howling the bloody night long. A horrid racket. And since the murders, it seems to bother me more. So many things do. Our house. What an old creaker it is. Mark you, I'm not complaining. Really, it's quite a serviceable house. Has all the mod cons. But oh, how it coughs and grunts. And after dark, when the wind commences, that hateful prairie wind, one hears the most appalling moans. I mean, if one's a bit nervy, one can't help imagining silly things. Dear God. That poor family. No, we never met them. I saw Mr. Clutter once, in the Federal Building. Early in December, in the course of a single afternoon, two of the cafe's steadiest customers announced plans to pack up and leave not merely Finney County, but the state. The first was a tenant farmer who worked for Lester McCoy, a well-known western Kansas landowner and businessman. He said, "I had myself a talk with Mr. McCoy. Tried to let him know what's going on out here in Holcomb and hereabouts. How a body can't sleep. My wife can't sleep, and she won't allow me.
So I told Mr. McCoy I like his place fine, but he better hunt up another man. Count of we're moving on. Down to East Colorado. Maybe then I'll get some rest.
The second announcement was made by Mrs. Hideo Ishida, who stopped by the cafe with three of her four red-cheeked children. She lined them up at the counter and told Mrs. Hartman, "Give Bruce a box of Cracker Jack. Bobby wants a Coke. Bonnie Jean? We know how you feel, Bonnie Jean, but come on, have a treat." Bonnie Jean shook her head, and Mrs. Ishida said, "Bonnie Jean's sort of blue. She don't want to leave here. The school here. And all her friends."
"Why, say," said Mrs. Hartman, smiling at Bonnie Jean, "that's nothing to be sad over. Transferring from Holcomb to Garden City High. Lots more boys."
Bonnie Jean said, "You don't understand. Daddy's taking us away. To Nebraska." Bess Hartman looked at the mother, as if expecting her to deny the daughter's allegation.
"It's true, Bess," Mrs. Ishida said. "I don't know what to say," said Mrs. Hartman, her voice indignantly astonished and also despairing.
The Ishidas were a part of the Holcomb community everyone appreciated. A family likably high-spirited, yet hard-working and neighborly and generous, though they didn't have much to be generous with. Mrs. Ishida said, "We've been talking on it a long time. Hideo, he thinks we can do better somewhere else."
"When you plan to go?"
"Soon as we sell up. But anyway, not before Christmas. On account of a deal we've worked out with the dentist. About Hideo's Christmas present. Me and the kids, we're giving him 3 gold teeth. For Christmas." Mrs. Hartman sighed.
"I don't know what to say. Except I wish you wouldn't. Just up and leave us."
She sighed again.
"Seems like we're losing everybody. One way and another."
"Gosh. You think I want to leave?" Mrs. Ishida said. "Far as people go, this is the nicest place we ever lived. But Hideo, he's the man, and he says we can get a better farm in Nebraska. And I'll tell you something, Bess." Mrs. Ishida attempted a frown, but her plump, round, smooth face could not quite manage it. "We used to argue about it. Then one night I said, 'Okay, you're the boss, let's go.' After what happened to Herb and his family, I felt something around here had come to an end. I mean, personally. For me. And so I quit arguing. I said, 'Okay.'" She dipped a hand into Bruce's box of Cracker Jack. "Gosh, I can't get over it. I can't get it off my mind. I liked Herb. Did you know I was one of the last to see him alive? Uh-huh. Me and the kids. We'd been to the 4-H meeting in Garden City, and he gave us a ride home. The last thing I said to Herb, I told him how I couldn't imagine his ever being afraid. That no matter what the situation was, he could talk his way out of it." Thoughtfully, she nibbled a kernel of Cracker Jack, took a swig of Bobby's Coke, then said, "Funny. But you know, Bess, I'll bet he wasn't afraid. I mean, however it happened, I'll bet right up to the last he didn't believe it would. Because it couldn't. Not to him." The sun was blazing. A small boat was riding at anchor in a mild sea. The Estrellita, with 4 persons aboard. Dick, Perry, a young Mexican, and Otto, a rich middle-aged German.
"Please, again," said Otto, and Perry, strumming his guitar, sang in a husky, sweet voice a Smoky Mountains song. "In this world today, while we're living, some folks say the worst of us they can. But when we're dead and in our caskets, they always slip some lilies in our hand. Won't you give me flowers while I'm living?" A week in Mexico City, and then he and Dick had driven south. Cuernavaca, Taxco, Acapulco. And it was in Acapulco, in a jukebox honky-tonk, that they had met the hairy-legged and hardy Otto. Dick had picked him up. But the gentleman, a vacationing Hamburg lawyer, already had a friend, a young native Acapulcan who called himself the Cowboy. He proved to be a trustworthy person, Perry once said of the cowboy. Mean as Judas, some ways, but oh man, a funny boy, a real fast jockey. Dick liked him too. We got on great. The cowboy found for the tattooed drifters a room in the house of an uncle, undertook to improve Perry's Spanish, and shared the benefits of his liaison with the holidaymaker from Hamburg, in whose company and at whose expense they drank and ate and bought women. The host seemed to think his pesos well spent, if only because he relished Dick's jokes. Each day, Otto hired the Estrellita, a deep-sea fishing craft, and the four friends went trolling along the coast. The cowboy skippered the boat. Otto sketched and fished. Perry baited hooks, daydreamed, sang, and sometimes fished. Dick did nothing, only moaned, complained of the motion, lay about sun-drugged and listless like a lizard at siesta. But Perry said, "This is finally it, the way it ought to be." Still, he knew that it couldn't continue, that it was, in fact, destined to stop that very day. The next day, Otto was returning to Germany, and Perry and Dick were driving back to Mexico City, at Dick's insistence. "Sure, baby," he'd said when they were debating the matter. "It's nice and all, with the sun on your back. But the dough's going, going, gone. And after we've sold the car, what have we got left?" The answer was that they had very little, for they had by now mostly disposed of the stuff acquired the day of the Kansas City check-passing spree. The camera, the cufflinks, the television sets. Also, they had sold, to a Mexico City policeman with whom Dick had got acquainted, a pair of binoculars and a gray Zenith portable radio. "What we'll do is, we'll go back to Mex, sell the car, and maybe I can get a garage job. Anyway, it's a better deal up there. Better opportunities. Christ, I sure could use some more of that Inez." Inez was a prostitute who had accosted Dick on the steps of the Palace of Fine Arts in Mexico City. The visit was part of a sightseeing tour taken to please Perry. She was 18, and Dick had promised to marry her. But he had also promised to marry Maria, a woman of 50 who was the widow of a very prominent Mexican banker. They had met in a bar, and the next morning she had paid him the equivalent of $7. "So how about it?" Dick said to Perry. "We'll sell the wagon, find a job, save our dough, and see what happens." As though Perry couldn't predict precisely what would happen. Suppose they got $200 or $300 for the old Chevrolet. Dick, if he knew Dick, and he did, now he did, would spend it right away on vodka and women. While Perry sang, Otto sketched him in a sketchbook. It was a passable likeness, and the artist perceived one not very obvious aspect of the sitter's countenance. Its mischief, an amused, babyish malice that suggested some unkind cupid aiming envenomed arrows. He was naked to the waist. Perry was ashamed to take off his trousers, ashamed to wear swimming trunks, for he was afraid that the sight of his injured legs would disgust people. And so, despite his underwater reveries, all the talk about skin diving, he hadn't once gone into the water. Otto reproduced a number of the tattoos ornamenting the subject's over-muscled chest, arms, and small and calloused but girlish hands. The sketchbook, which Otto gave Perry as a parting gift, contained several drawings of Dick. Nude studies. Otto shut his sketchbook. Perry put down his guitar, and the cowboy raised anchor, started the engine. It was time to go. They were 10 miles out, and the water was darkening. Perry urged Dick to fish. "We may never have another chance," he said. "Chance? To catch a big one?" "Jesus, I've got the bastard kind," Dick said. "I'm sick." Dick often had headaches of migraine intensity. The bastard kind. He thought they were the result of his automobile accident. "Please, baby, let's be very, very quiet." Moments later, Dick had forgotten his pain. He was on his feet, shouting with excitement. Otto and the cowboy were shouting, too. Perry had hooked a big one. 10 feet of soaring, plunging sailfish. It leaped, arched like a rainbow, dived, sank deep, tugged the line taut, rose, flew, fell, rose. An hour passed, and part of another, before the sweat-soaked sportsman reeled it in. There is an old man with an ancient wooden box camera who hangs around the harbor in Acapulco, and when the Estrellita docked, Otto commissioned him to do 6 portraits of Perry posed beside his catch. Technically, the old man's work turned out badly, brown and streaked. Still, they were remarkable photographs, and what made them so was Perry's expression, his look of unflawed fulfillment, of beatitude, as though at last, and as in one of his dreams, a tall yellow bird had hauled him to heaven. One December afternoon, Paul Helm was pruning the patch of floral odds and ends that had entitled Bonnie Clutter to membership in the Garden City Garden Club. It was a melancholy task, for he was reminded of another afternoon when he'd done the same chore. Kenyon had helped him that day, and it was the last time he'd seen Kenyon alive, or Nancy, or any of them. The weeks between had been hard on Mr. Helm. He was in poor health. Poorer than he knew. He had less than 4 months to live. And he was worried about a lot of things. His job, for one. He doubted he would have it much longer. Nobody seemed really to know, but he understood that the girls, Beverly and Eviana, intended to sell the property. Though, as he'd heard one of the boys at the cafe remark, "Ain't nobody gonna buy that spread, long as the mystery lasts." It didn't do to think about. Strangers here, harvesting our land. Mr. Helm minded. He minded for Herb's sake. This was a place, he said, that ought to be kept in a man's family. Once Herb had said to him, "I hope there'll always be a Clutter here, and a Helm too." It was only a year ago Herb had said that. Lord, what was he to do if the farm got sold? He felt too old to fit in somewhere different. Still, he must work, and he wanted to. He wasn't, he said, the kind to kick off his shoes and sit by the stove. And yet it was true that the farm nowadays made him uneasy. The locked house, Nancy's horse forlornly waiting in a field, the odor of windfall apples rotting under the apple trees, and the absence of voices. Kenyon calling Nancy to the telephone, Herb whistling, his glad, "Good morning, Paul." He and Herb had got along grand, never a crossword between them. Why, then, did the men from the sheriff's office continue to question him? Unless they thought he had something to hide. Maybe he ought never to have mentioned the Mexicans. He had informed Al Dewey that at approximately 4 o'clock on Saturday, November 14th, the day of the murders, a pair of Mexicans, one mustachioed and the other pockmarked, appeared at River Valley Farm. Mr. Helm had seen them knock on the door of the office, seen Herb step outside and talk to them on the lawn, and, possibly 10 minutes later, watched the strangers walk away, looking sulky. Mr. Helm figured that they had come asking for work and had been told there was none. Unfortunately, though he'd been called upon to recount his version of that day's events many times, he had not spoken of the incident until 2 weeks after the crime, because, as he explained to Dewey, "I just suddenly recalled it." But Dewey and some of the other investigators seemed not to credit his story, and behaved as though it were a tale he'd invented to mislead them. They preferred to believe Bob Johnson, the insurance salesman, who had spent all of Saturday afternoon conferring with Mr. Clutter in the latter's office, and who was absolutely positive that from 2 to 6:10 he had been Herb's sole visitor. Mr. Helm was equally definite. Mexicans, a mustache, pockmarks, 4 o'clock. Herb would have told them that he was speaking the truth,
convinced them that he, Paul Helm, was a man who said his prayers and earned his bread. But Herb was gone.